Welcome to the Flourishing After Addiction podcast. I'm Carl Eric Fisher, an addiction psychiatrist and bioethicist. In this podcast, I'm exploring addiction and recovery through deep dive interviews with people from various walks of life, all working toward flourishing after addiction. People researching addiction and recovery, clinicians, spiritual teachers, activists, people with lived experience, and generally, people studying how to change and grow. So, I continue to have a lot of new listeners and email newsletter subscribers in the wake of my book launch, so thank you all for joining us. If you haven't signed up for my newsletter yet, you can head over to my website where you can sign up there and also receive a free guide I've made about the many pathways to recovery. This episode will be somewhat of an introduction. It's a window, in a way, into a key question. What does history have to do with addiction anyway? In the process of my own recovery from addiction, and in researching and writing my book, I felt a pull to the topics beyond traditional science and medicine to understand what happened to me and my family. In the process, I found that fields like history, literature, and philosophy all had tremendous potential to help make sense of addiction. So what I've been doing in this podcast and what I generally like to do in my work is to take these intellectual topics and rigorously return them to specific, actionable questions about what we do in the world, how we change and grow, how we work with addiction, and how do we work with the universal elements of addiction that I believe are in us all. So this episode's interview is with Ben Breen. Ben is an associate professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and the author of the book, The Age of Intoxication, Origins of the Global Drug Trade. I was so excited to talk to Ben because, like I mentioned briefly at the outset of the interview, when I met him, it was absolutely pivotal in my own understanding of the history of addiction. Ben has such a love for history, and I was immediately struck by his wholehearted devotion to his field and his conviction, which he talks about, that history is deeply useful and can help us to understand phenomena like addiction today. In both his own example as a scholar and directly by helping me in my own research process, Ben was tremendous. I doubt I could have done it without him. It was a real pleasure to return to some of these guiding, motivating questions now that the whole thing is out in the world. So, for example, we talk about the deep history of addiction and drugs. In particular, how ideas about good and bad drugs go all the way back to the colonial period hundreds of years ago. And specifically, how those hidden, unconscious assumptions strongly influence what we think we know about addiction and drugs. This really matters, in one way, for example, because these ideas are at the root of legal regimes that are not based in reason and really strongly influence some of our ideas about how drugs work. We also talk about psychedelics. Ben goes into a fascinating and overlooked early history of the very first psychedelic therapists, forgotten era of drug experimentation that stretches far back before the common association of psychedelics with the 1960s counterculture. And in fact, he traces a line from bioprospecting in the Amazon jungle all the way through to the cultural craze for psychedelics, with important implications for how we understand and use those therapies today. And there's much more. Cinnamon, tobacco, unicorn horns, bath salts, decriminalization, drug scares about coffee, the true roots of opium, and how it was turned into an exotic substance. I love Ben. The minute you think he's going off on some wild academic tangent, he just brings it right back to how it affects our lives and the way we understand addiction today. In that way, it's like every conversation I've had with Ben. It's always surprising, mind-expanding, wide-ranging. I hope you agree, and I hope you enjoy. So I'm here with the historian Ben Breen. Ben, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So Ben, let's jump right into it. I met you really early in my own historical journey, trying to make sense of the history of addiction. You gave a talk at Columbia, and you may not even know the full story from my side, but I was interested in the history of addiction, but I wasn't really finding what I was looking for. And you were a major, major resource and boon to me early on. Like, you had such excitement and energy and just belief and encouragement in the notion that the study of history had something to add to addiction. In your case, talking about different ways of looking at opium. But I just wanted to start us off here because I have a feeling you might have a nice way of articulating this, probably more articulate than me. What does the study of the history have to add to our understanding of addiction today?
To me, I think history has something to add to almost everything today. So it's an easy one for me to answer in a glib way. In a general sense, I think of history as the memory banks for the human species. So it informs our future actions inherently because it's providing not just context, but like lessons learned, evidence of past failures. I do believe that you can just take away a certain level of predictive power from history, some ability to make policy decisions based on the past. But it, specifically in the terms of addiction, I think the big picture takeaway in my thinking about the history of addiction, and I think yours as well, it's a changeable subject. It's not fixed in time. It's not fixed across cultures either. But one way to think about it is that even the culture of addiction in the 20th century West has changed a great deal between then and the present. And even more so if we go back 200 years, 300 years, and of course, 2000 years, it's completely different. So understanding that full sweep, which I think your book does a really good job of, I think is the only way to understand addiction, because otherwise it just comes across as a fake construct that we're imposing and making what historians always like to call anachronistic claims about. So if we don't understand it as something that changes over time, then I don't think it actually has much meaning at all for us today.
Of course, I agree with that. I agree with the very kind words, but I also agree with the notion that addiction is an idea and maybe even a set of ideas that changes over time. But a skeptic might say, if we take a general view of addiction as some sort of breakdown in self-control, we can look to the past and we can see examples that are really suggestive. We can look at Alexander the Great. We can look at Mark Anthony. We can look at Pepys. We could look at all these people who seem to have had something like we would call addiction if they were somehow time traveled up to the present. So the skeptic's objection might be, aren't we splitting hairs? Like, how much is addiction even different from then to now?
Right. Yeah. No, I agree. I actually do have a pretty firm belief in the fundamental unchangeability of human nature. So in the level of humans having a certain orientation toward the world, a certain relationship between each other interpersonally, and also just a built-in set of biological constraints, such as the way that our brains process emotion and substances, I do believe that there's more continuity than not. However, one way I think about it when I teach this, I just finished teaching a history of drugs class, and we had a debate at the end of the class a few days ago about whether drugs should be legalized or not, which really hinged on their addictiveness. The students kind of on their own started bringing up these sorts of debates that we're currently referring to, the question of whether addiction is something permanent in the human condition, whether it's more of a construct, whether it's a combination of the two, which is sort of where I fall. And one thing that was helpful, I think, in clarifying their thinking and mine is, let's just take a concrete example, the word alcoholism. In some ways, we could actually compare this to the word scientist, in fact. In both cases, I think the general public might think that it's a longer and older concept than is actually the case. In both cases, my understanding is they're 19th century terms. I know scientist is. You tell me, but I believe alcoholic was not used prior to, do you know, Carl, the late 19th
century? I don't think it was even used widely until the 20th century.
Yeah, I think that maybe it's even early 20th century. Yeah. And the point is, the scientist example, I think, is very well studied by historians of science. Isaac Newton was not a scientist. He was a natural philosopher, because he didn't have the term scientist available to him. And that actually really matters, because in his self-fashioning as a human being and as his professional positioning as a person who's doing work in what we now call the sciences, if you don't have the term scientist, you don't have that professional category. And in a fundamental way, you don't have that sense of self as a scientist. And it changes the questions you ask. For instance, a natural philosopher had a more religious orientation toward the understanding of knowledge. Isaac Newton famously got engaged in alchemy. He was obsessed with biblical chronology. And for him, that was all part of being a natural philosopher. And then later in the 19th century, it stopped being part of being a scientist. And I think there's something very similar when we have someone who, to our terms, like Mark Anthony is a good example. He, I think it's pretty easy for us to say, had alcohol use issues. He was famous for having depression that coincided with bouts of drinking. It affected his job performance.
Yeah, he puked in his lap during a celebratory procession. It's not a tough call here.
He was hungover when he had to give a speech in front of the Roman Senate. So I think I'm not denying that he did have alcohol use disorder, I think. I mean, if we want to make retroactive diagnoses. But at the same time, he was not an alcoholic in some fundamental sense that he didn't see himself as one. He didn't have the term available. And I think that's true across the board. I think that we can say that people had issues with addiction. I'm happy to say that as an historian, but when we're trying to understand their own experience of themselves in history, it's actually really important to say they didn't have that self-conception. And so much of addiction and so much of thinking about drugs in general is based on a subjective experience that I think it's really important that we don't see that as an unnecessary distinction or something that's just sort of not entirely important. I think it's actually pretty fundamental to understanding the terms because so much of what we're talking about when we talk about addiction and the history of drugs as well is really trying to get inside someone's head and understand what their subjective experience was. So we can say that people have impulse control issues throughout history. I'm happy to say that. And I just said myself that I personally, when I think about people, yes, I'm able to say Mark Anthony had addiction issues. But as an historian on a professional level, I actually find a lot of value in being a little bit hesitant to do that and thinking through what does it mean if we say someone, an early modern way of saying it, so 16th century, 17th century European way of thinking about it would be that perhaps they were a slave to their passions. And what does that mean to say you're a slave to your passions as opposed to a drug addict or an alcoholic or these 20th century terms that we overlay on the past?
That's really helpful. So people didn't have the self-conception of the status or category of being an alcoholic. That's really useful. And I see a connection to the debates about addictiveness too. So you were just talking about your students debating about legalizing drugs. Even legalization is a messy term. We can talk more about that. But it sounds like there was something about the status of addictiveness, of applying some sort of category classification to a compound or a substance that mattered for that debate. And that's probably a great bridge because you wrote a fantastic academic book, again, about the early modern period, way back over half a millennium ago. And you talk a lot about intoxication. So maybe talk to us about addictiveness. Like, how did that come up? How does that even inform a debate about legalization or good drugs versus bad drugs?
Yeah, I'm happy to. This is very much what the book is about. And the book, just to summarize the argument, the main thing it's trying to do is make a larger case for the history of drugs as a whole, as a product of early modern European imperialism and colonialism. So I'm not just talking about the history of addiction, but also the concept and the term drugs, which emerges sort of out of somewhat mysterious territory in the Middle Ages. It probably comes from medieval Dutch, and there's some claims of an Arabic root for the word drug, actually, interestingly. But it's sort of an unclear etymology. What we do know is that it solidifies its connotations with recreational and medical use in the early modern period, but I would argue specifically in the 17th and 18th centuries. And that's very much a product of a new reckoning with, for purposes of this discussion, we'll just call it addictive, even though I just did the whole thing about how addiction is historically constructed. I just think it's simpler just to start using the term, especially because in the 18th century, they do start having a modern concept of addiction in some sources. So we can talk about George Salmanazar, one of my favorite imposters in all of history, who was pretended to be a prince from Taiwan, but was actually probably an orphan from southern France. And he was active in the first half of the 18th century, and I think did start to use addiction. He applied the terms of addiction actually to many things. He talked about addiction to study, addiction to idolatry in the context of his sort of invented description of a made-up religion that he claimed was active in Taiwan, modern-day Taiwan. But he also described opiate addiction. And so I think that when we get up to the 18th century, we do see something that looks more familiar in terms of people describing addiction to opiates and alcohol in something like modern terms. But it's still confused and, by modern standards, quite a bit more complex because it also gets tangled up with fears of basically what we would now call Orientalists' imaginings of the other. So it's notable that these early uses of addiction to describe alcohol and drug use are often applied to people from South Asia or from the Americas. So the book is sort of unpacking all of those changes. And it's basically making a big picture argument that if we want to understand the modern story of drugs, meaning the 20th and 21st centuries, it's imperative that we look at the colonial period, because this is the beginning of these distinctions between, as you put it, bad and good drugs. And from those, I think, mostly arbitrary distinctions, we have a legal regime that makes them not just codified in law, but like literally changing people's lives in negative ways for decades. We're talking millions of people, tens of millions of people globally, who have been imprisoned due to drug laws, which in many cases are based on very flimsy assumptions that don't really stand up to historical scrutiny. So the book is both an academic investigation, but also there's some element of contemporary policymaking that was on my mind as I was thinking it through.
Right. So the division, one of the dimensions that solidifies there by 1700, 1750, is drugs versus medicines. What is the actual, I know there's a lot there, but talk more about what's a drug. It wasn't a drug in, say, 1400. By 1700, it became a drug. So what are those, maybe this is a place to talk about the racist and the colonialist attachments too, but what are the things that get attached to the idea of a drug?
Right. So it's funny, for this book research, I basically had to become an 18th century apothecary. And so I could get really deep into the terminology. Some of it's really interesting because it involves, you know, unicorn horns and lots of mythical animal parts are being sold by apothecaries. Unicorn horns, by the way, I think were narwhal tusks. So they actually do have like material origins in actual animals, but they're getting confused.
Yeah, allegedly mystical.
Yeah. And a lot of these things really did cross over a lot with magic. So one way to think about it without getting too much into terminology is that the term drug was used pretty broadly. It seems like it has origins in the, I mentioned medieval Dutch, in a word that is cognate with the English word dry. So it's like dry goods were drugstores. That means that if you went to a druggist, you might be buying medicine, you might be buying dye stuffs, you might be buying other forms of powdered goods like spices, which I don't think there's a strong distinction between drugs and spices in the early modern period. And to a certain extent today, actually, right? There's some crossover. But you'd also maybe be buying tobacco. So when we talk about recreational drugs versus medicines, it's a really good example of how we have modern categories that don't quite apply to this older concept of drugs, where tobacco was both medicinal and recreational. Cinnamon was perceived by some source authorities to be a psychoactive drug or nutmeg, but it was also used in cooking. So we have things that are recreational, but pharmaceutical or medical that are combined, but also things that are foods and drugs combined. We also have poisons. So famously in Romeo and Juliet, there's an apothecary in the play who plays a central role because he sells, quote, mortal poison to Romeo. And that's actually like a key plot point. It leads to the tragic finale of the play. And he's selling medicine, but he's also selling poison. And so he's portrayed as a little bit of a shady apothecary, a little bit down on his luck. His shop is portrayed as kind of dusty, so he's having difficulties economically. But nevertheless, I think that when we think about drugs, we have to keep in mind that there was no distinction between medical and recreational in that modern sense, nor was there really a distinction, I would say, between foods and drugs. It's all one continuum, and it changes over time again. But one of the things I love about this topic is that it lets me study the history of alchemy, the history of cooking and food. It lets me study the history of poison, which is a special interest of mine. And actually, maybe we can circle back to this. Even though the word addiction is not really a prevalent early modern concept in its modern sense of meaning substance use disorders, it is true that intoxication has a much deeper Latin root, which is in wide use for hundreds or even thousands of years. But it's really, the root is the English word toxic, right? So the idea of poisoning yourself is, I think, a much more long-lived concept and has a deeper historical story. So that, I think, if we want to get into what made some drugs, why some drugs were perceived to be worse than others, it crosses over a lot with this concept of poisoning yourself, which is, I think, quite fair because some of these drugs really were quite bad for you. So one example is 18th century Portuguese apothecary who says that if you have lung problems, you should take orpiment, which is a toxic mineral, or arsenic, and basically throw it on a fire and breathe in the smoke, which I think is probably borderline fatal. I don't know how people even survive doing that. But that's an example of the kind of crazy stuff that an 18th century or 17th century drug manual might recommend.
Right. And it has such amazing resonances with the 20th century too, because we can pick like any decade, basically. The early efforts for criminalization with the Harrison Act, and then the criminalization of marijuana, and then even all the way up to, well, certainly the present day, but like the 1970s Controlled Substance Act. Totally arbitrary distinctions, not at all based on harms. And to this day, people get in big trouble for pointing out the non-rationality of the way we legally classify different drugs. David Nutt in the UK got in huge trouble for pointing out that alcohol is a big problem and we probably underappreciate its dangers and we overestimate the dangers of something like cannabis. But the dose makes the poison. And I love this idea of intoxication as toxin, because most of these things are toxins, right? I think they're not universally good and fine at any dose. Basically, any intoxicating substance we talk about will be dangerous at a certain point. So which ones we describe as poisons versus which ones we describe as medicines, that seems to be in a way socially constructed. Like it has to come from somewhere else. And so you talk about racial fears, you talk about religious fears and tropical medicine, and that's how some drugs becomes, if I understand correctly, the enemy of civilization. It's somehow got some sort of shady association with something potentially harmful. Is that right?
Somewhat, yeah. I think that's mostly right. I think the main thing I want to add to that is it has a lot to do with not just this concept of civilization, which is very much like an Enlightenment European 18th century concept, but also the formalization of the concept of medicine as a profession. And science as a profession. So it's not just culture as a whole or societies as a whole constructing these distinctions. It's specifically medical professionals. The professionalization of that category of a man of science or of a physician, which are the terms that were used a lot in the 18th and 19th centuries, is really key here. Because just to make some examples of past drug scares that I think are instructive, you know, I was born in the mid-80s, so the crack epidemic was all in the news when I was a kid. Now we're living through what's called the opiate epidemic or opioid crisis, these different terms we use. And it's really instructive to remember that those ideas of drug scares go back quite far. But we're often, I think my students and I myself, when I was studying this, were often surprised by the drugs that are the scary ones in different time periods. And the key thing there to understand, and just to throw out one example, coffee. Coffee was actually considered kind of a fearsome drug in the mid-17th century. There's a famous legal case where in Paris, someone is sued because they're brewing coffee on the premises. And it's considered to be like almost like a disturbing the neighbors because it's this sort of strange drug. I'm not going to liken it to like cooking methamphetamine, but it was, if you imagine suing someone for brewing coffee or roasting coffee beans, it gives you a sense of how strange it was held to be and actually potentially dangerous. Another famous example, of course, is gin, the gin craze in 1720s, 1730s London, and you know, Europe more generally actually, was a huge deal. So what is making people, and specifically what is making medical professionals label things as epidemics or as crises? I think the major thing to understand there is that the longevity of a drug, or we don't have to call it a drug, the longevity of a kind of subjective mental experience in a culture, be it a mental illness or experience with drug addiction or other forms of, you know, basically culturally constructed reactions that are nevertheless overlaid on biological processes. Those things really are scary insofar as they are new. The novelty of certain drugs is what made medical professionals scared of them or inclined to condemn them. In the case of gin, the idea of alcoholic spirits, of distilling alcohol, is pretty old. It goes back to medieval Arab and Persian medicine, and I think it goes back over 1,000 years in that context of a somewhat esoteric alchemical process to make distillations. But the idea of going to a bar and buying a glass of alcoholic spirits is pretty new. So it dates back to about the 17th century.
Yeah, to say nothing of from a cart.
Yes, exactly. Someone walking around selling gin.
Even worse, vended by a woman.
Yes, yes. Or the idea, you know, because it's new, there's no sense of you have to have license to buy it And if you're a kid, you're not allowed to buy it, right? Or you get cut off by a bartender after a certain point. These kind of social codes didn't exist when it was fully, when it was first fully rolled out, we might say, in society. And as a result, it was hugely destabilizing, and it legitimately was a problem. I'm not saying this is socially constructed at all. I'm saying it really was quite an issue in the social fabric of the 18th century to have widespread alcoholic spirits available. But eventually, medical professions kind of adapt. And when they can't adapt fast enough, I think is when we have these ruptures where something becomes not just criminalized, but stigmatized. So a great example is there's very long-standing traditions of use for many psychoactive substances, going back to the Roman period, ancient Greece, medieval Islam, that make their way into Western medicine pretty much intact through the 18th and 19th centuries. But then there's other things, for instance, peyote or ayahuasca or psilocybin mushrooms from the New World, which had no precedent in Western medicine, and therefore almost immediately get labeled as demonic or somehow corrupting of society. So I think it's really actually medical professionals making choices based on not fully articulated fears that they have, or really just a fundamental fear of novelty that's informing a lot of this.
Mm-hmm. So because we meaning medical professionals, lag behind in our understanding of the full scope of the human experience of intoxication, there's a sort of reactionary move toward not just criminalization, but stigmatization.
Yeah, it goes back to the sort of the unexamined assumptions of, especially, and I'm not really talking right now about medical professionals in the present, but if you go back to someone in the year 1800 or the year 1700 who's a physician, they have a huge number of more or less unexamined assumptions about, just to take an example, someone in the year 1800 writing in London might make an assumption that Christianity is an important value for a physician to uphold. Or they might make an assumption about sort of debunked 19th century or 18th century notions of racial science in thinking about the effects of drugs on different human bodies. And these things, I'm arguing, stick around even after we've tossed away or debunked a lot of these actual explicit assumptions. There's still an underlying set of associations that we don't really collectively look at very much. Great example being, we can talk about opiates, which I should say are actually a very interesting exception to what I've been saying. The opium poppy is actually native to Central and Western Europe. And this is actually a fairly new finding that archaeologists have been developing evidence that it's actually native to the foothills of the Alps, or maybe Iberia, or maybe France. But these are actually the earliest documented places where we have found evidence of human use of opium poppy seeds. We don't know yet if that's it being used medicinally as a painkiller or for, like, for instance, making foodstuffs like oil. Probably, I suspect it was probably both. And this is evidence dating back 3000 BC, 4000 BC, further than that, I believe. And it's not until kind of more recent historical time that opium becomes really strongly associated with India, China, Persia, Afghanistan, right? So it's a strange, I find it quite fascinating as a topic because it's one of the only exceptions to this rule. It turns out opium is actually a homegrown product of Western European medicine, which has been present in the medical tradition of Europe before there was a Europe, right? It goes back to ancient Greece. But then somehow in the 18th century, it flips over into an association with China, let's say, or India. And I think to understand that, it's a whole other story about the expansion of global empire and really the rise of modern capitalism and some other things we haven't touched on. I'm sort of flagging that because it's probably one of them. I think maybe the most important drug of all in the last 300 or 400 years, arguably. And it sort of stands alone as a special case. And when I say it, I mean opium, but then we can also broaden that to mean opium-derived products like modern-day OxyContin, morphine, heroin, et cetera.
Yeah, the East-to-West dynamics and tension there are so fascinating, and how they recur with such a strong sense of amnesia is just endlessly curious. But this is, I mean, there's so much to unpack here, and I really recommend your first book, The Age of Intoxication, but I want to bridge this because I think in the comparison, there might be some useful themes emerging. Now you're working on a book about the 20th century. So how do you get from 1500s, 1600s, trekking through the Amazon in search of foreign plants to what you're working on now? What's the connection there?
Yeah, it is a connection. I will acknowledge it's a big leap. So I'm trained as someone who's reading, you know, 17th century documents in Portuguese or even Latin sometimes, or Spanish, or even 17th century English is actually quite a bit different from modern English. So it's somewhat esoteric stuff. Like the research I was doing for my first book is in musty archives in places like where you are now, like in Lisbon, where it's books that people haven't really read or cared about much for the past few decades. And what I found when I was talking about this book to my students in particular, who have really been incredibly helpful in shaping my thinking more recently, they kept asking me about contemporary debates. So for instance, where I'm talking to you right now from Santa Cruz, California, where quote unquote plant medicines, I'm using scare quotes, not because I denigrate the term, but just because I'm indicating that that's the actual definition being used in this legal code. Santa Cruz changed this legal code to allow plant medicines to be used more or less. I don't know if it's fair to say they legalized them, they decriminalized them. So they can be used without threat of prosecution. And what that means in practice is psilocybin mushrooms, ayahuasca. However, peyote is actually a special case because it has a sort of protected legal status as religious sacrament. So I got a lot of questions along these lines about decriminalization efforts of psychedelics and also questions about psychedelic therapy. And I started thinking about it more myself because as I have been studying this topic, the ground has really shifted. So I started thinking about this topic when I was in graduate school, right around 2009, 2010. And since then it's been over a decade. And I think we're heading into a future that looks quite a bit different than what I expected. Things are moving faster in the field of especially psychedelic science than I had reason to believe they would. Just based on the past, things kind of ground to a halt for much of this last few decades of the 20th century. Now it's moving fast again. And when I mean moving fast, I mean scientific breakthroughs and new discoveries about, for instance, the role that psilocybin might play in treatment for addiction, ketamine used for major depression, but also social changes, just the kind of changing stigmatization of these drugs, their prevalence in pop culture, their economic role. Like there's a huge amount of money flowing into the psychedelic science industry now. I think it was fair to say that it didn't even exist as an industry when I started thinking about this topic. So that started getting me thinking about the origins of this more recent concept of psychedelic science, which obviously does not go back that far because the word psychedelic itself is a product of the late 50s. But still, it has a deeper history than I think a lot of people think. And so this book that I'm working on now is actually, in a way, rewriting that history, making arguments about the 1930s and anthropologists in particular of the 30s and 40s as a key inflection point in the integration of psychedelics into a larger medical and scientific tradition. Whereas before they had been sort of, you know, in some ways operating in a continuous cultural pattern that didn't have a fundamental break with pre-colonial eras, especially, for instance, in Amazonia, in parts of Mesoamerica, in the first case, ayahuasca, in the second case, psilocybin mushrooms have been used in an uninterrupted cultural pattern for centuries, but it really started to shift before the 1960s. So what I've been realizing is that we have a story we tell about psychedelics as a sort of element of the 1960s counterculture, which are then banned, but we don't really tell much about the story that connects the indigenous past of psychedelics to the 20th century. That connecting point is sort of lost in that popular narrative. So that's what I'm excavating. And it's been a lot of fun because it lets me also pick back up on, you know, the themes that I sort of just waved at and said goodbye to at the end of my book, my first book, which ends roughly around the year 1800. Now I'm like studying late 19th century Brazilian ethnobotanists and people taking peyote and mescaline in the 1920s. There's a really good book by Mike Jay called Mescaline, A Global History, I believe.
Mm-hmm, a new one, yeah.
Really, it's so interesting. Like, just knowing about, you know, people writing about mescaline in 1890s London it's different than you expect. It's legal, and it's kind of just like an object of scientific interest. William James had a really bad experience with it where it just gave him food poisoning. But I always wonder if he had really loved peyote when he took it, I think in the 1880s, if that then, because of William James is so renowned, maybe it could have gotten, maybe we could have seen some form of psychedelic therapy in the Victorian era, which is a kind of fun counterfactual to think about. I don't think it's totally impossible to imagine, but it just didn't go that way.
It's so interesting that my experience has been people date the beginning of some sort of drug or addiction related phenomenon way too late and usually have a massive block of amnesia for some earlier development. So people tend to date, for example, the history of addiction mutual aid recovery societies like AA to AA, maybe a couple little precursors with a nod to like, oh, there are these Christian groups like the Oxford group, but there are addiction recovery mutual aid societies in the 1840s. And then you can see analogs in Native American cultures and all the rest. And then likewise with addiction medicine and therapeutic approaches to addiction, it kind of starts out of the really harsh prohibitionist classic era. And so in the 1930s, 1940s, that was the golden age, but they're missing that there is this whole 19th century move toward really holistic and integrative therapeutic approaches to addiction. And it sounds like you're talking about the same sort of thing. Like people want to date psychedelic psychotherapy as far back as like maybe their parents told them about, but there's this whole uncovered history. Tell us a little more about I know this is a work in progress, but I'm just curious, like, could you paint us a picture? Like when you say anthropologists are working on integrating psychedelics into medicine or providing a new perspective or a new framework for understanding psychedelics, like who is it? What are they actually doing?
So it's been a lot of fun to research because one of the things I've found is, well, two things. One, World War II prompted a more or less forgotten era of drug experimentation associated with, are you familiar with the term narcosynthesis?
Only a little bit. Tell us what that means.
It's basically this idea, I think it's somewhat coming out of Freudian psychiatry, but it's definitely a different spin on it, where it was a treatment for wartime trauma. What was known as like battlefield fatigue was often, or war neurosis was a term that was used a lot. We would now say PTSD, but that's a more recent way of talking about it, but something very much like PTSD among especially soldiers in World War II. They were given very large doses of sodium amytal or other sort of hypnotic or sedative medications, which are more or less not used anymore because they're fairly dangerous. And in this case, their treatment was actually quite extreme insofar as people would be on the edge of consciousness in a sort of twilight state, sometimes for 12 hours, 24 hours. And they would talk to a therapist in this moments where it was actually initially perceived to be almost a miracle cure for trauma. Now, I don't know the science of this. I don't know if this is actually a good treatment or not. I suspect that it's a mixed bag, probably. And I think part of why it's not done anymore is simply because it's physiologically quite dangerous and not good for the human body to be exposed to that level of a sedative drug. There's a really interesting documentary film by the famous director John Huston called Let There Be Light, which was made, I believe, in 1945 or 1946, but was not released until later because it's pretty harrowing and pretty intense, sort of fictionalized documentary about this treatment for World War II veterans, which actually shows a staged version of this treatment. And from that came, I'm arguing, a really fundamentally new way of thinking about psychotherapy as informed by direct real-world aims and experiences. So this is people kind of inventing a new treatment pattern on the battlefields of World War II. And those people ultimately become some of the first psychedelic therapists as well in the 1950s and 60s. But what they're experimenting with different drugs, and it's moving through this kind of classic process in the history of drugs where something is thought of as experimental and is tested in animal trials, or there's not a really good use for it. And then society just invents a use based on what society is trying to fix. In this case, the trauma of war, trying to generate a world of peace after World War II. And so this idea of drug therapy as a new modality for science to adapt, it gets woven into a lot of utopian visions of the future, a way of preventing war, a way of reshaping human society. And anthropologists are a crucial bridge there because they are pioneering this idea of applied science, this idea that science needs to be responding to real world conditions, and it needs to actually be reshaping the world in a more, I don't know about holistic, but a way that is intentionally grounded on the idea that we need to embrace diversity of human experiences. We need to draw on knowledge traditions from around the world. And that's actually quite a fundamental shift in mid-20th century science that kind of gets erased, partly because I think a lot of people today, especially in anthropology, would say it's at best a naive way of thinking about ways of using knowledge. Some might say it's actually was quite damaging. It was sort of a product of a certain kind of liberal American mid-20th century notion of science as something which is, if not inherently good, then at least has a huge potential to do good in the world, that I think has been challenged a lot in the past few decades. And also, it's important to say, I'm not convinced in this book project I'm working on now that it was actually successful at all. I think a lot of these early experiments with psychedelic therapy were actually hugely unethical and damaging to the patients. Others were neutral and others were positive, but it's very much a mixed bag. And so in terms of relating it to the present moment of psychedelic therapy, I think there's good reason why contemporary scientists don't cite these earlier studies and episodes. At the same time, as an historian and as just someone who thinks about policy and bioethics, there's huge amounts of lessons to be learned from this first generation of psychedelic therapy that just don't get remembered if we start the story with the 60s instead of the 1930s, right? I could talk more about the anthropology part. One thing that hasn't come up much in this discussion is both of my current book and the first book project, I'm really interested in what's known as bioprospecting, even though it's a term that can be used kind of in the 20th century terms to mean, say, going into the Amazon jungle and looking for a useful, medically useful plant that's native to South America, sort of commercializing it. But more generally, I think it's a fundamental part of European imperialism, the British Empire, the Portuguese Empire, the Dutch Empire. One of their main engines of those empires was finding commercially or medically valuable drugs. So the British, like tea, opium, tobacco. And the same with the Portuguese, all of those drugs were a huge part of it, and also spices. In many ways, that kind of continues up through the 20th century. So one way of rethinking the history of what happened in the late 50s as psilocybin mushrooms are, for the first time, moved out of their regions of traditional use in the highlands of Mexico and turned into first psilocybin, like a synthesized drug derived from the mushroom, and also into a pop culture phenomenon, like Gordon Wasson, a mycologist and banker writing about mushrooms in Life magazine, where the word magic mushroom is first used, I think in 1957. That process is very much, I would argue, a 20th century version of the colonial process of someone, you know, Gordon Wasson was, I think he worked for J.P. Morgan. He went to all the good schools. He was well-connected in the East Coast establishment. When someone like him take psilocybin mushrooms, it suddenly flips a switch and turns them into an object of scientific study in a different way. Or when William James takes peyote, for instance. In many ways, I see that as very similar to the process by which, say, early modern drugs were integrated or not into Western medicine. So I think there's a lot of continuity there that we kind of forget because we're not, maybe like me, spending a lot of time reading 18th century apothecaries and drug manuals and so forth.
That's so fascinating. I love that. Bioprospecting. And I think about a prospector laden with all of their little tools. And in this case, we're laden with all of our colonialist assumptions about how drugs work and us versus them and the different types of drugs. That's really cool. You've mentioned Portugal a few times. So I want to go there. You and I were discussing offline. I've moved to Portugal, at least for the short term, in part to study drug policy. And a lot of folks know that Portugal is internationally famous for this really ambitious and in some ways revolutionary decriminalization project, but also decriminalization paired with the social services. And I've been thinking a lot about it, and I know this is not so much what you were studying when you were over here in Portugal on your Fulbright, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I know this wasn't what you were studying when you were over here on a Fulbright, but Portugal was also in the news pretty recently about vaccines. And so it's probably the best nation that's not a small island nation at COVID vaccination rates. And there's also a lot of speculation about that, why Portugal would be the one that's quote unquote the most successful. And I think some superficial takes that they didn't politicize it. Well, okay, great. Everyone's trying not to politicize vaccines. So why did it work in Portugal and not other places? And so you're someone with a really long view of Portuguese history and culture. And I just want to invite you to widely speculate on what is going on here. Like what, my hypothesis is that it's not just because they came up with a cool technocratic revolution and came up with the right plan for dealing with drugs. And it's not just that they came up with the right technocratic plan to just talk about vaccines in the right way and put a submarine captain in charge of their vaccination. There must be something else. There must be something else in the Portuguese culture and the psyche that's working here. Is there any way that you see this connected to what you've been studying and the way that this little corner of Europe has made sense of drugs and addiction and social programs in general?
I love that. I love the idea of wild speculation here because I haven't done much of it, actually. This was the first book came out of my PhD thesis. And so when you're writing something like that, you're not really rewarded for wild speculation too much. So I think I'll go out on a limb and I will make a couple guesses. One thing that was on my mind a lot when I was living in Portugal, which was a while ago, my Fulbright was 2010-11, I think. And so that was, again, over a decade ago. And even then, decriminalization of drugs in Portugal had been widely rolled out and widely hailed. I think there was a New Yorker article about it around that time. And it was in the news quite a bit when I was there. And definitely on my mind quite a bit. But another thing that was on my mind was I lived in a sort of next to a nightlife area of Lisbon. And within walking distance of my house, well, a couple of things. One thing was that there's the Museum of Pharmacy in Lisbon, which was right around the corner from me. In front of that museum was, on Friday and Saturday nights, a very popular spot for drug dealing. I think mostly MDMA and cocaine, like nightlife drugs, which was, you know, fascinating to me because I just watched The Wire, and like in Portugal, it was seemed to be a functional version of an experiment they do in that show where you just let people sell drugs and suddenly violence goes down. All the other social problems associated with drugs, they don't go away, but they're greatly reduced when you remove that element of police harassment from the equation, which is not to say it was entirely removed. Portugal still has issues with that, but it was way different than what I had seen living, for instance, in Austin, Texas, or New York City, right? But the other thing that was on my mind was that in walking distance also of my house was what was called a smart shop, which sold what I think we could term gray market drugs, like drugs that are not yet criminalized, but later were. Mm-hmm. One of them was what is known as bath salts. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm, sure.
So they're known as bath salts, but they're actually cathinones. They come from a drug from the Horn of Africa called Khat, K-H-A-T. They're a synthetic version of that, which I find really interesting. I keep wanting to read a book on the history of that. But I went into the shop just because I was studying the history of drugs and I was intrigued by this, like, it was like a shop that had a little mushroom on it. What is this place? And when I was looking at the packaging, the labels on a lot of these drugs that were, again, being sold openly in Portugal, but even at the time in the US some were criminalized, others were very much fast-tracked and on the way to being criminalized. I noticed it seemed to me like maybe the shop was part of a Dutch chain, or at least a lot of the drugs were packaged in Amsterdam and then sold in Lisbon. And probably produced, if I had to guess, in China, quite possibly. So it's very international, but if we think about, this is the wild speculation part, what is going on with Lisbon and Amsterdam? Both of them are famous cities when it comes to drug legalization or decriminalization in the recent era. If we look back at what it was like to be living in Amsterdam or Lisbon 500 years ago, 400 years ago, 300 years ago, those are the two centers of the global drug trade, you could argue, or at least two of the major centers of the global drug trade throughout the entire period of colonialism. They're also two of the longest centers of the drug trade, meaning they go back very far. You know, even before Christopher Columbus, before 1492, there were Portuguese mariners and slave traders in West Africa doing what we would call bioprospecting, I would argue, 1450s, 1460s. Very similar with the Dutch. They're part of the medieval spice trade, and then they move into the drug trade. And so perhaps there's something to do with these two capitals, Amsterdam and Lisbon. We could think of them as maybe having the longest experience with this more global vision of drugs. And perhaps it's somehow rubbed off on their governance structure. And I know I'm talking only about Lisbon, but honestly, Portugal is like one third of the population is the Lisbon metro area. So it's similar to the Dutch, where it's dominant capital city. Perhaps that kind of accumulation of experience with drugs over centuries has, I hope, encouraged a little bit more of a broad-minded view of them, as opposed to a place where, again, it's about novelty. Like maybe a place that is newly exposed or unfamiliar with the drug trade would react more vehemently or in a more less thoughtful way than these cities, which have like such deep historical experience.
Mm. I think that's really compelling, Ben. I think when you look at the history of drug epidemics, and I use the word epidemic intentionally because people have called them epidemics throughout history, novelty is often one of the major deciding factors. It's not about some inherent addictiveness of the drug, but it's like you were saying earlier, if a society doesn't have social mores and it doesn't have the social wisdom of how to use a drug, that's often a chief factor in drug use getting out of control, drug use causing harms, and also often related, not necessarily always in lockstep, the moral panics that come along with the drugs. It's not necessarily the whole story, but it makes sense to me that there is some acceptance of the fact that drugs are a part of life and that human cultures use drugs and people use drugs for reasons. Some acceptance of those like relatively basic notions allows for a more useful social policy where we're not just trying to stamp out a drug, not this idealized notion of we can just crush something. We have to pay more attention to the root causes driving use. I still don't totally see the connection to the vaccine stuff. There might be something there about interconnectedness. And if you're part of a cosmopolitan city, then you recognize that if you get sick, you're going to hurt somebody else and vice versa. I don't know.
Well, one thing that really came up, actually, the final moment of my drug history class that just ended when my students had that debate was, I think I was really proud of them because I think entirely organically on their own, you know, I gave them the example of Portugal and I said, that's one of your options. Would you advocate for decriminalization, but not legalization, right? And what they came up with, which I think is, quite germane to what we're talking about here about the vaccine element, is they said, yes, we would advocate for decriminalization. That's probably the best option, but it relies upon socialized medicine because one of the things that Portugal has going for it is a pretty effective healthcare system, which is very much, as far as I can tell, more cohesive and seemingly more effective in terms of mental health care than the United States. And I think that one of the commonalities between the Netherlands and Portugal is that they do have socialized medicine. They have a much more robust system of public health care for mental health issues. And so, you know, my students were talking about the Portuguese case is if drugs were entirely legal in Portugal. But my understanding, at least when I lived there, was that if you are perceived to have a substance use disorder, you have sort of a mandated psychiatric evaluation or some kind of mental health treatment is at least offered to you, which I believe is, if not entirely free, mostly free, meaning it's subsidized in a way that I don't really think we have set up in the United States.
Nowhere close to it. No, nowhere close to it. I think if a use is problematic enough, it doesn't go on someone's legal record, but they're brought before a committee where someone is strongly encouraged to get help. And the focus, because there's no legal sanction and because there's no criminal record, the focus is squarely on what is going to help this human being in front of us. And as part of that, it's not just about, oh, let's go to therapy and make you feel better or talk about how to manage your negative emotions. It's also attending to, and this is something we talked about on this podcast with Ryan Hampton about what's the most effective form of social change that might help with addiction problems. In Portugal, they give you a job. They move you up to the top of the job queue. And that's a really great public health intervention. And in the United States, our corporatized system of medicine allows society to pass off the externalities of profit-seeking, inequitable medicine onto people. you don't get that escape. You don't get that out in a country with a single payer system, whatever this is. And so by paying more attention to health equity, I think they have to, they must, they're forced to encounter the real costs of human health and public health. And we get to pretend in the United States that we can be insulated from each other in this individualistic dream, which is so clearly a fantasy. I think a lot of commentators said, oh, COVID will show us all that we're all interconnected and that public health really matters. Nope, that didn't happen. So maybe it's just too deep in our psyche. But anyway, Ben, I love that it came back to your students. We were back around full circle to the start of the conversation. It's really great. I really want to thank you for coming on the podcast and helping us to understand some of these tangled threads. There's clearly much more to be said. And we're all really eagerly anticipating your book on the untold history of psychedelics. Anything else? Any other final thoughts or calls to the audience? You want to plug your first book or leave us with any other parting words of wisdom?
I would just say, I'm really glad that people are talking about all of these issues. I think one of the biggest problems we have, at least in the past few decades as a global society, is not being willing to have not just an open mind, but to an acceptance of multiple frames of reference, a sense of allowing multiple points of view to coexist on this topic, rather than just having a rigid conception of this is obviously the right way to treat this issue. The issue of addiction and the issue of the role of drugs in society, I think, is one of the most complex ones we can encounter as a contemporary social problem, which we seek to find a quick fix for. And it keeps reoccurring. As you said, there's always a different epidemic of drugs at some point. I'm sure it'll happen again in the news with a different category. And so just having these kind of open discussions, having popular histories like your book and I'm sure many of your guests' work, and really just allowing for that public forum without stigma, I think is the most important thing we can do in many ways. So just want to say, keep up the good work.
Well, thank you very much, Ben. Very kind of you to say. I couldn't agree more. And I certainly don't pretend to be the final arbiter in anything, but I think the need for recognizing the multiple pathways of recovery and multiple conceptions of addiction and different identities that people might hold across society or into the past or into the future, who knows? I really believe in that project. So thanks for helping me. Thanks for being my companion and a reader and a real supporter. So it's really great to see you again. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Cole.
That's my interview with Ben Breen. I hope you enjoyed it. I just loved his many articulations of the promise of looking at history and the promise of looking at addiction across various viewpoints. As Ben said, the issue of addiction is one of the most complex issues we can encounter as a contemporary social problem. I would actually add to that and say the issue of flourishing after addiction is one of the most complex issues. That's why I chose that for the title of the show, to reflect the deep challenge of searching for flourishing in life, both individually and collectively. I just think we need nuance and multiple perspectives here. I also thought there were such interesting elements to one of his key questions: what is a drug, after all? As Ben said, there's no meaningful distinction between medical and recreational substances, or even food, spices, poisons. We can see some of this arbitrariness through different drug scares, like the mid-17th century scares about brewing coffee. There's also this related issue of how medical professionals have gotten us into trouble again and again by not being clear about their unexamined assumptions and unconscious fears. This matters because today it obscures the actual benefits and harms of different drugs, as well as the full extent of addiction. I think if we treat addiction as if it's a relatively extreme and constrained problem, only about extreme drug use, we miss out on the full scope of the phenomenon. Finally, I really appreciate Ben's perspective on Portugal and taking the long view of socio-historical ideas about drugs and addiction. We could start this story about Portugal from roughly 20 years ago when it decriminalized drugs, or maybe a little earlier to the more proximal origin of its drug problems. But no surprise, I'm partial to Ben's way, to see it as a capital of drug trade with a history stretching back hundreds and hundreds of years. I love the notion that one thing that we have to learn from these cultures like Portugal and say the Netherlands is an acceptance that drugs and even drug problems are a part of human life. So that's it for this week. Thank you for listening. Please subscribe on your podcast player, leave a nice review, and share it with people you think would find it interesting. And because we're still less than a month out, please check out my book. Some of the video of the events from the book launch have been posted online, like my conversations with Leslie Jameson and Beth Macy. So check that out on my website. If you have bought my book, thank you so much. And if you enjoy it, please spread the word and tell people you think would enjoy it. Thank you for being a part of this project of mine, and talk to you soon. This podcast is for general informational purposes only. It isn't medical or clinical advice. The content is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you have questions, please consult a medical professional. Conflicts of interest are an important topic in addiction and recovery. For now, this podcast is just me bringing these conversations to you ad-free for their own sake. I do have a list of disclosures about my work and positions on my website, which I will keep updated.